You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings, and happy Halloween. I'm Mike O'Hanlon with the Foreign Policy Program. I have the real honor and pleasure of introducing my friend Steve Pfeiffer, and then having a bit of a conversation with him after he opens this discussion with some thoughts of his own. Before we go to you, I can see it's a very distinguished crowd. I appreciate your enthusiasm coming out on a gorgeous fall day and on Halloween to discuss this topic that maybe is appropriate in some ways, because all kidding aside, it is certainly one of the scariest topics out there in international security policy. And yet it's often a forgotten topic these days, except when we look at crises, whether it's North Korea's latest nuclear test, or maybe Vladimir Putin moving a missile into Kaliningrad and making us worry about nuclear dangers. But the whole subject of arms control and nuclear arms control, which Steve will be talking about, as well as a broader discussion of nuclear weapons policy writ large, is one that's been a little bit put on ice in some sense, especially with the deterioration of U.S.-Russia relations and the inability to pursue a traditional arms control agenda. But Steve, nonetheless, in a paper that he's produced that I think all of you are aware you can access either here in hard copy or via the website in both longer and shorter forms, he recognizes this is a crucial subject for the next president of the United States for a number of reasons, which he'll get into, some of them having to do with just framing a vision and trying to be patient and wait for the opportunity perhaps to pursue it later, some of them having to do with choices that we could consider in the near term. And certainly no subject could be more important to our nation's security, even if it hasn't always been the one that got the greatest attention on the campaign trail. Although I will quickly point out in passing that our former colleague Bruce Blair, a longstanding nuclear arms control expert, was just recently in a Hillary Clinton commercial pointing out the stakes here. And obviously he had one candidate in mind more than another for who he was trying to support and who he was trying to critique, but he went into his ICBM launch control facility and reminded people about what we're actually talking about here when we're talking about nuclear weapons issues. So Steve Pfeiffer, as you know, is a scholar here at Brookings. He's the director of our Arms Control and Nonproliferation Initiative. He's also a member of the broader Center on 21st Century Security and Intelligence and the Center on United States and Europe. He is a longstanding career foreign service officer before arriving at Brookings, and some of his most distinctive roles over that 27-year tenure, as I recall, involved not only being ambassador to Ukraine, but also a member of the U.S. negotiation delegation that led ultimately to the INF Treaty, and more generally, a scholar and practitioner on Russia and Eurasia issues, including at the National Security Council. So a very distinguished career, and with no illusions about the nature of dealing with Russia on many of these issues. But of course, it's not just about U.S.-Russia relations, as I mentioned, and Steve will lay things out. So without further ado, let me hand the floor over to him. I'm just going to remind you that he's going to open up with some comments. Then he and I will have a little bit of a discussion, and then we'll look forward to going to you for your questions as well. So actually, why don't you join me in welcoming and thanking Steve for this great paper, and thanks for being at Brookings.
Okay. Well, Mike, thank you very much, and thank you all for coming out. What I tried to do in this paper was look at some of the arms control choices that the next administration would face when it takes office in January. And it does so, or it will do so, at a time when the prospects for further U.S.-Russian nuclear arms control are pretty bleak. But I would still argue that, A, arms control can make a significant contribution to U.S. national security, and, B, arms control is actually more important when U.S.-Russia relations are more adversarial than they were, say, 4 or 5 years ago. So I argue in the paper that the next administration should seek to engage Moscow on a new dialogue on arms control, seeking both further reductions that would go beyond the New START Treaty, but also being prepared to address some of the issues that the Russians have raised over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And the goal here initially would be to test Moscow's readiness to engage. So the first question, why focus on Russia? Well, Russia, like the Soviet Union before it, is the only country in the world that could physically destroy the United States in a matter of minutes. That gives us an incentive. And going back now almost 50 years, you've had successive American administrations engage with Moscow and the Soviet Union, then Russia, on agreements to limit and then reduce nuclear weapons. So the SALT talks, the Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, the START negotiations, and also unilateral steps. And you now have the latest agreement, the New START Treaty of 2010, which will bring each side down to about 1,550 deployed strategic warheads on no more than 700 deployed missiles and bombers by February of 2018. And that's within an overall context where the estimates are that each side has roughly 4,500 total nuclear weapons when you count not just the deployed strategic weapons, but reserve strategic and non-strategic. Now, differences emerged between the Obama administration and the Russian approach already back in 2012, where the Obama administration was pressing for further reductions going beyond the New START Treaty, talking about bringing in not just deployed strategic weapons, but also non-strategic weapons, addressing reserve strategic, and opening the possibility that you might have a U.S.-Russian negotiation that would cover the entire arsenal on both sides. The Russians indicated not much interest in further nuclear reductions, but instead pressed issues like missile defense, advanced conventional strike weapons, and third country nuclear forces, even though there's a huge gap between the United States and Russia at about 4,500 apiece and everybody else at about 300 weapons or lower in terms of the nuclear arsenals. It's not really totally clear whether the Russians raised these questions as a pretext not to get into a negotiation on further nuclear cuts, or they, whether they reflect real concerns. You know, my guess is it's a combination of both. But as you had this emergence of differences in the arms control approaches, you also had deterioration in the U.S.-Russia relationship to today, where it's probably at its lowest point since the Cold War ended back at the end of the 1980s. Differences over Syria, Ukraine, differences in the arms control area, the administration concerned, for example, that Russia has violated the Treaty on Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces by testing a ground-launched cruise missile of intermediate range. And this takes place against a backdrop of significant modernization of Russian strategic forces, most of which, or much of which, is simply replacing old stuff with newer stuff, which is what we'll be doing in 10 years' time, but also a more belligerent approach in general towards the West, and a certain degree of nuclear saber-rattling that is disquieting. So you're going to have a relationship looking forward that's going to be a mixture of issues where there are sharp differences between Washington and Moscow, and on issues where the interests converge, for example, the Iran nuclear program, where they can work together. And my guess is that for the foreseeable future, the U.S.-Russia relationship is going to have that mix. Now, on the arms control side, there are not a lot of grounds for optimism in the near to medium term, but I try to be optimistic, so let me throw out two reasons why you might not totally give up. One is reportedly Russian diplomats told their American counterparts that once the New START Treaty was fully implemented and the limits then took full hold in February of 2018, at that point they might be prepared to have a more serious conversation. The second point is just history. Is you can go back and find a couple of instances, 2008 and then in 1984, where you had the U.S.-Soviet or the U.S.-Russia dialogue at a very low point, nothing going on in arms control, and then within a year, things had changed fairly dramatically. So I don't think the president in 2017 should expect that kind of dramatic change, but also should not exclude it. And so if Russia is ready to engage, Washington's going to want to have a position to engage them on. And if Russia is not ready to engage, then I think there actually still is a reason to have a forward-looking arms control position. Some of you may have seen that last week, the United Nations General Assembly voted to convene a negotiation on a ban on all nuclear weapons. This was over the objections of the United States, Russia, Britain, France, and others. But that kind of thing invariably is going to generate more pressure on the United States than on other countries. And it's difficult to fight something with nothing. So if the United States has its own position that is moving in the direction of further reductions, it'll be in a stronger position to push back against that pressure. Now, the paper looks at some of the questions the administration might take a look at. First of all, it will inherit a strategic modernization program of record that flowed from the Obama administration's nuclear posture review and subsequent studies, and talks about a new ballistic missile submarine, a new intercontinental ballistic missile, a new B-21 strategic bomber, and also a new long-range air-launched cruise missile. And one of the things I think the administration will want to ask is look at what are its definition of its requirements, and does it need to do all of that? Now, ideally, it'll be a combination of force requirements and strategy that determine your force structure. But we don't live in an ideal world. And I think it would be unwise to omit the budget considerations. And one of the things that we do have about the current strategic modernization program is anybody who talks about it at the Pentagon, when it gets the question of money, says, we don't know how we can afford this. And that's potentially a problem. So I would factor that in. So you could ask questions like, do you need to maintain a triad of intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and bombers? Do you need to stay at the planned number of 700 deployed missiles and bombers? Do you need a new air-launched cruise missile if the B-21 bomber has stealth and electronic warfare capabilities that would allow it to operate in a sophisticated air defense environment? We originally built air-launched cruise missiles back in the 1970s because the B-52 was a huge target on a radar screen. It couldn't penetrate Soviet air defenses. The B-21, however, is supposed to be different. So that's a question. The administration will want to think about issues like nuclear policy. It will want to think about, if there is a negotiation, what sorts of positions does it want to take? The New START Treaty expires by its terms in 2021, but it can be extended by up to 5 years by agreement of the sides. Does the administration want to extend that treaty? If it goes beyond New START, what sorts of numbers does it have in mind? What do you do about non-strategic weapons? What do you do about reserve strategic weapons? So there's a list of questions that the administration will have to think about. And then you get into the related questions that the Russians have raised. So, for example, on missile defense, which has been an increasingly contentious issue between Washington and Moscow, if the Russians were prepared to talk about nuclear reductions, are there things that the U.S. government could do on missile defense that might be of interest to the Russians? Advanced conventional strike, this is an issue that the Russians raise because they say that with the increasing accuracy of conventional weapons, in some cases, conventional weapons can now perform missions that used to require nuclear weapons. So are there some ways to address that issue? Third country forces. The Russians say it's time to expand the talks. It can't be bilateral. I agree in one sense that you can't have arms control be forever just the United States and Russia. But I'm not sure you need to bring other countries in now, given the huge disparity between the two superpowers and everybody else. But if you decided to think about that, are there some ways that you could begin to involve at least, say, Britain, France, and China, the third, fourth, and fifth largest nuclear powers? So those are the sorts of issues. The last part of the paper says the recommendations to consider. And my first recommendation was I think the new administration should do a nuclear posture review. It should decide what are its requirements, what strategy does it want to have to guide its strategic forces. And then it should look at the current strategic modernization program, the program of record that it will inherit, and ask, does that meet its requirements? But again, should ask the question, can it afford that program? I would recommend that the next administration reaffirm that the United States would maintain a triad. Submarine-launched ballistic missiles on submarines make sense because they're the most survivable leg of the triad at this point. Once they go out to sea and underwater, it's very hard to find them. Bombers have advantages both because they perform conventional as well as nuclear missions, but also bombers are more readily usable than missiles if you want to signal concerns. So, for example, we've seen in the last year, I guess, both B-1s and B-52s used to overfly South Korea in a way that was sort of demonstrating American support for South Korea. The ICBM leg has been the one that many outside government question. I actually would support the ICBM leg for two reasons. One is I think submarines are going to remain invulnerable, but you see increasing talk about undersea drones, things like that. I'm not sure we can make that assumption. So ICBMs would be in part a hedge against the compromise of our submarines at sea. But the other point is, I could see in a crisis an adversary, if they could track our submarines, saying, I can take those submarines out, and that's not going to cross the threshold that would provoke an American nuclear response. It's very different with ICBMs. If an adversary wants to take out the American ICBMs, they have to pour hundreds of nuclear warheads into the heartland of America, and they have to be absolutely sure that that would provoke a nuclear response. So I would keep the triad. The one element I would put on hold, at least suspend, is the air-launched cruise missile. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to me in terms of a specific mission, but in particular when we have a bomber that will be designed to operate in a more difficult air defense environment. I would then look at the force structure and ask the question, do we need 700 deployed missiles and bombers as the current plan calls for? And that would fit exactly under the New START treaty limit. Because you can actually go lower and still actually maintain the 1,550 deployed strategic warheads. You may lose a little bit of flexibility, but you can do some things. And for example, you could go down to 500 and still have a force of 1,550 deployed strategic warheads. But that force of 500 missiles and bombers would result in some fairly significant cost savings in terms of construction and life cycle operations. Nuclear policy. I think the administration should take a look at something this administration talked about but didn't quite move to, and that would be making the sole purpose of American nuclear weapons the deterrence of a nuclear attack on the United States, on American allies, or American forces. And my starting point is that at this point in time, the United States actually has a policy of no use of nuclear weapons against most of the countries in the world. You know, if you're a non-nuclear weapon state, if you're abiding by the NPT, our policy is we would never use nuclear weapons against you. And thinking through, and this would have to be a policy adopted only after a lot of consultations with allies both in Europe and Asia, but it's very hard for me to conceive of circumstances in which an American president would use nuclear weapons first if nuclear weapons had not been used against the United States or an American ally. Thinking a little bit further, at this point in time, parity, exact equivalence in numbers with Russia, seems to matter less today in strategic terms. And the Obama administration and the Obama Pentagon in the past have actually said, we don't need to have exact parity. Now, at the same time, what they have said, there are political considerations that might make parity important. One is the U.S. has had this policy of nuclear forces second to none. If we were to move away from that, does that create some anxieties on the part of some American allies who are dependent on the American nuclear deterrent? The other question is, if you have a significant gap between Russian numbers and American numbers, does that make your negotiation more difficult? I think that's a serious question to consider. But I would also put down the warning, be careful about getting weapons as bargaining chips, because sometimes you find if you can't cash the chip in, you end up having paid a lot for a chip that you may not find, you know, particularly useful. So while not foreclosing unilateral steps by the next administration, it seems to me that the logical thing to do is seek to engage the Russians in a negotiation aimed at both mutual reductions but also addressing some of those concerns, except for the new air-launched cruise missiles, and I would basically suspend that program. So this would mean reaching out to the Russians at some point, you know, not too far into the new administration, saying Washington's prepared to engage in a negotiation on further reductions, but also is prepared to have serious conversations on missile defense, advanced conventional strike, and third countries. Also, though, with one additional point, and it would be important to indicate to the Russians that there needs to be full compliance with the INF Treaty. All of this becomes very, very hard to do, including the idea of getting a new treaty through the Senate, if there are still concerns about Russian observance of the INF Treaty. So in terms of further nuclear reductions, what the paper recommends is that the administration seek to negotiate an agreement that covers all, U.S. all deployed, non-deployed, strategic, non-strategic, everything in the U.S. and Russian arsenals. And it suggests an aggregate limit of no more than 2,200 warheads. That would be about a 50% cut from the current level, but it would still leave Washington and Moscow each with seven times as many weapons as any third country. Within that overall limit of 2,200, the proposal is for a sublimit of 1,000 deployed strategic warheads, which would cover primarily the warheads on intercontinental ballistic missiles and submarine launched ballistic missiles. Those are the weapons of most concern. And then you would have a limit of 500 deployed strategic missiles and bombers. Now, I think this would interest the Russians in several ways. First of all, the reduction in the limit on strategic delivery vehicles on missiles and bombers coming from 700 down to 500, that would actually bring the American force down to what it looks like the Russian force is going to be for the foreseeable future. Moreover, it would also reduce the American upload capacity. Most of our missiles, in fact, probably all of our missiles, under the current plan, will carry less than the number of warheads than they could. But that also allows for the possibility to upload if there's a breakdown in the treaty. And my back-of-the-envelope calculation was that the U.S., if the treaty were to break down, could add over 1,000 warheads to its deployed missile force. And reducing that, I think, would be of interest to the Russians. But it would also be important to indicate to the Russians you'll address these other questions. So on missile defense, a couple of things. One, reiterate the offer that was made in 2013 for an executive agreement on missile defense transparency. And the idea here is to give the sides do a declaration every year that says not only current numbers of interceptors, launchers, and radars, but also looks out 10 years and says, these are the projected numbers 10 years from now, so that the other side can see, is that a problem or not? And if it says there's a problem, it then has advance warning that can act. But I would also consult with NATO and say, are there some ways that we could consider capping the number of SM-3 missile interceptors in Europe? Because that seems to be the focus of the Russian concern. And although the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with Iran addressed nuclear weapons only, not ballistic missiles, I worry less, and I think Europeans I've talked to worry a lot less about an Iranian ballistic missile with a conventional warhead than one with a nuclear warhead. And does that create some possibilities, for example, to maybe do something about the SM-3 side in Poland? On advanced conventional strike, I would suggest that the government, U.S. government, could offer a side agreement if we proceed with hypersonic glide vehicles, which seem to be the systems of most concern to the Russians, that you could limit them at a relatively low number, because the Pentagon has been saying for several years now it doesn't need a lot of these things. And you could probably handle that fairly easily. The more difficult conventional question is going to be conventional cruise missiles, which are not necessarily prompt, you know, but there are large numbers. And the U.S. military has had an advantage of these for several decades and has been reluctant to, in fact, limit them. I think we've seen by the Russian use of both air-launched cruise missiles and sea-launched cruise missiles in Syria that the Russians are catching up. My guess is neither side is prepared to limit these sorts of capabilities, but at least have a dialogue and say, what effect do cruise missiles have on the strategic nuclear balance? My own sense is there may be some perceptions in Russia that are not wholly justified. On third country systems, it's very hard to figure out how you would actually do a negotiation among just even five countries, not to talk about the full nine. Because how do you come up with equal limits that would have some sense for where the United States and Russia are compared to Britain, France, and China? And although the Russians have called for this multilateral negotiation, they've not yet indicated a specific proposal, which I interpret to be they also can't come up with an approach. So what I would start a little bit more modestly, and the idea here would be if you had a U.S.-Russian agreement that was bringing U.S. and Russian forces down, you then go to the British, French, and Chinese and say, we would like you to undertake unilateral political commitments that as long as the United States and Russia are coming down, you won't build up. And that might be a reasonable way to begin to start to bring these countries in the process. Now, I think there's a chance, one, that these ideas, if you could translate them to agreements, could bridge the gap that emerged between Washington and Moscow 3 to 4 years ago, and also could produce agreements that ultimately are going to be in the U.S. security interest, and might have the advantage of even serving as a positive impetus towards a more positive, broader relationship, which arms control has done in the past. But the really big question here, and which I don't have the answer to, unfortunately, is does the Kremlin see this the same way? If the Russians are prepared to engage, you have some decent prospects. But if the Russians are not prepared to engage, and in fact Russia has decided that for whatever reasons in the near term, arms control that goes beyond New START doesn't really answer their security concerns, then I think the administration ends up with some difficult choices, particularly the question about do you do some things on a unilateral basis. Now, on the one hand, you don't want to take unilateral steps in a way that it looks like it rewards or ignores bad Russian behavior. And in the last several years, we've definitely seen some significant bad Russian behavior. But on the other hand, we don't want to lock ourselves into programs that ultimately we're not going to be able to afford or end up causing us to do things that we normally wouldn't want to do. And I think that's going to be a dilemma if the Russians don't want to engage. So where I came out of the bottom line of the paper is seek to engage the Russians on a mutual basis. But if the Russians aren't prepared to play, don't foreclose unilateral steps that you might be prepared to take depending on the requirements that the next administration comes up with in terms of its needs for deterrence, assurance, and stability. At that point, I'll stop.
Fantastic. Very rich, very concise. Thank you, Steve. I'm just going to follow up on four of the specific issues that you raised out of maybe the dozen to 15 important subjects that you discuss in the paper, and then I'm sure others of you will want to follow up as well. So I'd like to ask you, just to list the four, I want to talk about ICBMs a little bit. I want to talk about no first use policy, which we know President Obama was thinking about recently as well. testing of warheads, to the extent that you have a view on that. Of course, we're still in a moratorium on nuclear testing, but no ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. That's not your main focus in this paper, but I wanted to see if you wanted to touch on that. And I'll come back to each of these in turn. And then finally, Russia, and leave aside the current impasse in U.S.-Russia relations. How do you think about Russia's longer-term needs for nuclear weapons, at least as Russians define them, as we think about the potential for not just the next round of cuts, but deeper down the road or even going towards zero someday? Seems an impossible thought at the moment. But how do the Russians, you know, with NATO to their west and China to their south, how do they think about protecting their own territory with conventional and nuclear means? But let me maybe step through each of those one by one. And so on ICBMs, I think you make a very persuasive case, myself, for why we should keep that third leg of the triad. But as you well know, this is a rich debate. And Bill Perry has recently come out against the ICBM. And as you say, the budgetary pressures may come out against the ICBM as well, because we're going to, looks like, build the B-21 bomber for a combination of conventional and nuclear purposes regardless. Mm-hmm. We certainly need to replace at some future date the Ohio-class submarines, which will be getting old. So that leaves the ICBM pillar as sort of the potentially most strategically and budgetarily vulnerable. I guess my question, to put it all to a head, would you be willing, despite your desire to preserve the ICBM for us in some sense, would you be willing to delay or even kill the idea of modernizing it, replacing the Minuteman force? And as I understand things, the reason we're going to have a new ICBM, as much as anything, is because we'll run out of test missiles to keep maintaining the reliability of the Minuteman force 10 years from now. But if one were prepared to sort of scale back the size of the deployed force, you could create a whole new pool of available missiles for testing and maybe extend the life another decade or more. Is that an option we ought to be thinking about?
I think the ICBM leg is worth preserving. I don't think we need to preserve 400 deployed ICBMs. And actually, there were some suggestions that several years ago, the Air Force was actually prepared to go down to 300. The Air Force, I think, has made very clear that it would like a new intercontinental ballistic missile. There was a study done by RAND about 2 years ago, though, where RAND said if you took the Minuteman III, and the Minuteman III was first deployed back in the early 1970s, so it's been around for a while, you know, but it's gone through this continuous program of life extension and modernization. And the RAND study actually said that you could save quite a bit of money by just taking the Minuteman III and extending its life. And then, as you suggested, if we decided instead of having a force of 400 deployed ICBMs, we went down to, say, 250, that would make available 150 ICBMs for your continued test program. So you could continue to do the, I think it's between 3 and 5 reliability tests every year for quite some time. So that might be an option. And what it might do is it would at least, the problem that the Pentagon has in its strategic modernization program is in the mid-2020s, the plan is to be building a new ballistic missile submarine, a new ICBM, a new B-21 bomber, a new nuclear air-launched cruise missile, doing some life extension programs on warheads. At the same time, we're in the midst of building F-35s and KC-46 tankers and destroyers and attack submarines, things like that. If you decided to extend the life of the Minuteman, that might take the heavy Minuteman decision and push it down the road a little bit and at least lessen some of the costs that you might face. So I think it's something that the Air Force might want to take a look at again, simply from the cost perspective.
So let me ask about nuclear no first use. And as I understand things, as best we can from the outside, because, of course, this was apparently an internal administration decision, but a lot of it got into the light of day in the public discussion as well. It appears that President Obama in recent months, anxious to have some kind of an ongoing nuclear legacy in favor of reducing the role of these weapons in international politics, but stymied by the state of the U.S.-Russia relationship and other matters in his arms control ambitions, looked at a few specific policies he might consider, including the idea of nuclear no first use. And from all accounts on the outside, what it sounds like is his own cabinet essentially vetoed that idea. A soft veto, since they don't have formal vetoes over their own boss. But the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense apparently both reported back to the White House that our allies really didn't like this idea, because in a dangerous world that had been especially unsettled for the last 2.5 years or so, it made allies wonder if somehow this was yet again proof of America pulling back. And irrespective of whether our treaty alliance arrangements required in military terms, such an option. It just didn't look good at this moment. Do you have any sympathy for that argument? Yeah. Do you think that argument gets overtaken by events once we have a new president on January 20th? How should we think about that issue as we contemplate no first juice? Yeah.
Well, I actually favor the formulation sole purpose, which is a little bit different, but has some similarities. I think sole purpose deserves a hard look. You can't move to either sole purpose or no first use without a lot of very extensive consultation with allies. And it's a two-way street, but it's explaining what it means. And it was hard for me to see the administration being able to do that in the relatively little time it had left. So I think this is actually an issue probably better left to the next administration. But I think the next administration ought to think very hard about it. You know, and I would go back to a point I made, which is, under the negative security assurances that the Obama administration announced back in 2010, if you are a non-nuclear weapon state, party to the NPT, and in compliance with your nuclear non-proliferation obligations, there are no circumstances under which the United States would use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against you. Now, there's a little asterisk there. They said, look, if there was a huge development in the biological warfare area, the policy might be revisited. But that negative security assurance covers probably 95% of the countries in the world. That small group of countries that aren't covered are mostly nuclear weapon states. So I'm trying to think through the circumstances in which there might be a Russian or a Chinese or a North Korean attack on an American ally. That's much more likely an attack on the U.S. homeland that did not involve nuclear weapons. And thinking through how an American president would respond, what would she or he do? And it's very hard for me to see the American president saying, I'm going to use a nuclear weapon as a response, given the panoply of other conventional force capabilities that they have. Because that inevitably triggers an American first use, then you have to consider, does that trigger nuclear use by the country we attack, either against the U.S. homeland or against our ally? So I can understand why people say if you take the nuclear part out of the component, you are reducing the overall deterrent impact of American military forces. But again, when I try to think that through, it's hard for me to come up with a scenario that would be realistic in which an American president would say, they haven't hit us with nuclear weapons first, but I'm going to resort to the nuclear option. That was certainly an option that the U.S. government preserved throughout the Cold War in the 70s and 80s at a time when you had this huge disparity in conventional forces, where Soviet and Warsaw Pact tank numbers were 2 to 3 times those of NATO. But that situation has dramatically changed, and if the U.S. and NATO and our allies make some relatively smart decisions and relatively modest investments, we're never going to get back to that situation. So I think it is something that the next administration could seriously consider.
Just a clarifying question on that subject before I go to my third. The distinction between sole purpose and no first use, are you allowing for the possibility of an American preemption in the very strict literal sense of that term if indeed we see a nuclear attack about to be launched upon us? Is that why you're making the distinction?
That's the one circumstances which I could foresee an American president saying if you had absolutely compelling evidence, and it would have to be huge, that we're about to be hit in a large way with nuclear weapons. Sole purpose, to my mind, leaves that option open.
So I wanted to talk about nuclear testing, and I realize this may not have been quite as central to your paper as some of the other issues you've touched upon. But of course, just to review the bidding for where we are now, I guess about 20 years after the signing of the CTBT and, 17 years after the U.S. Senate declined to ratify. So we've learned a lot in those 17 years. We've learned that verification is perhaps pretty good because we've heard a lot of North Korean nuclear tests since then. And of course, at that very moment of 1999, that was right after India and Pakistan had done a lot of their tests, which we picked up pretty well as well. On the other hand, we have seen nuclear weapons tests by North Korea, raising the question of what's the best deterrent to others testing, if there's any relevance to the American program. We've seen the American plutonium pits hold up pretty well, maybe better than we thought they might at the end of the 20th century, which then perhaps reduces the pressure to think about replacing them with some other kind of variant. On the other hand, the Department of Energy and the Nuclear Security Agency have this concept for reducing the number of warheads in the inventory. Now, my understanding is those don't require new pits or new testing, but I just want to ask, your take. And then finally, we have the question of potential new uses for nuclear weapons, even though you just said that you favor sole purpose. But what about, you know, the hypothetical North Korean buried nuclear weapon that can only be pursued by an earth penetrator or what have you? Is there any new case for a different type of American nuclear weapon, perhaps a small one that could burrow deeply before detonating? Putting all this together, how do you view where we should be on comprehensive test ban treaty, whether the next president, you know, if he or she sees an opportunity to pursue ratification, however much of a long shot that may be, should he or she propose that to the Senate? Should we consider testing nuclear weapons again in the foreseeable future? Any thoughts on that range of subjects?
Yeah. No, I continue to believe that the comprehensive test ban treaty and U.S. ratification would be in the U.S. interest. First of all, because we now have we have 20 years of experience with the Stockpile Stewardship Program, and I've actually had a chance to talk to a couple directors of the national labs, and they seem to be very confident that with that program, the United States is going to be able to maintain confidence in the reliability, the safety, and the security of its nuclear arsenal. So I don't see a need for us to test. The second point, as you mentioned, I think verification has improved over the last 15, 20 years. We don't know a lot about some of the U.S. national technical means because they're classified, but you do have this international monitoring system run by the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty Organization, which has now roughly 300 sensors around the world. You mentioned the North Korea test, which I think was picked up by 25 of those stations. So when you talk to people, it's you have to get along around a fairly complex understanding of geology, which I don't pretend to understand. But they basically are pretty confident you could detect a test anywhere in the world of 1 to 2 kilotons. And in some geologies, which happily include North Korea, the old Soviet test sites, maybe even down to 0.1 to 0.2 kilotons. So if you have that kind of confidence, it seems to me that the concerns that led the Senate not to approve ratification back in 1999, which was how do you maintain reliability of the American arsenal and how do you know that no one's cheating? I think that gives you actually some pretty good answers. But I guess I would actually go beyond that and just make the point, two other points, which I touched on very briefly in the paper, is just the political point. Look how hard Nevada as a state fought against storage of nuclear waste at what's now called the Nevada National Security Site. It used to be the Nevada Test Site. Do we really think that Nevada would say, sure, let's resume nuclear testing at a place about 60 miles from Las Vegas, and the population of Las Vegas is now triple what it was when the last nuclear test was done in 1992? Politically, I think that's in the very hard-to-do box. But I guess the last point I would make is if you look at the history of testing, we did as many tests as the rest of the world combined. And in many cases, we learned, I think, more. One example from my own experience in 1988, I went out to the Soviet nuclear test site. This was in preparation for a joint experiment we did with the Soviets. And they took us and they showed us a vertical shaft that they had drilled for one of their upcoming tests. And it was about a meter in diameter and went down, I don't know, maybe 500, 600 meters. And there was somebody from the Nevada test site who looks in the hole and says, boy, when the Soviets come next month to visit Nevada, they're going to be really surprised. And I said, why is that? He goes, we typically drill our vertical shafts about 3 meters in diameter. And that's 9 to 10 feet. And I said, why would you do that? The weapons aren't that big. And he said, it's not about the size of the weapons. It's about maximizing your area so you can hang instruments. So I think by that anecdote, we were probably getting a lot more information than others were. So the advantage of the test ban seems to me is, why would we not want to freeze the rest of the world in a position when they know a lot less about nuclear weapons than we do, and when we have what I think is probably the world's most sophisticated system for monitoring the reliability of the arsenal without having to resort to testing?
Excellent. And I'm just going to ask this one last question now, and you mentioned Russia. So let me now sort of broaden to a longer-term discussion. Let's imagine we're not in 2016 or even 2017 or 2018. I can't imagine if she wins that Hillary Clinton and Vladimir Putin are going to begin with a love fest that leads to a quick nuclear arms control accord. So it's probably going to be a while, as you say, for a lot of reasons. But let's imagine we've gotten beyond this immediate tough problem in U.S.-Russia relations, and we can imagine the next round of nuclear arms control in some sense being responsive to the fundamental military requirements as the two countries define them. And you've already made the point, and I find it persuasive, at least, that United States doesn't have a whole lot of military needs for nuclear weapons beyond deterrence of nuclear use against us, or sole purpose of preventing that kind of attack against the United States or its allies. But Russia may see things differently. It has a huge landmass, a shrinking population, rising superpower to its south, an alliance that at least it says it perceives as hostile to its west, although I don't always know how sincerely to take the Russian protest that they really fear NATO, but they certainly resent NATO. In any event, when you put all this together, what do you think Russians, maybe the Russian leader beyond Putin, are like, but Russians in general, how are they likely to define their long-term nuclear needs? And do you think it's possible to get to a point where we're talking about only hundreds of strategic warheads per country, or is that just going to be inconceivable, even looking out decades?
Yeah. No, I would like to get to that point. I think it's going to be very hard with Russia, because for some of the reasons why, I've argued elsewhere that if I had a magic button here and I could push that button, and verifiably all the nuclear weapons in the world would disappear, I would probably push that button. Because from an American point of view, given geography, the Pacific Ocean, the Atlantic Ocean, alliance structures, powerful conventional forces, that seems to me to be a pretty positive world in security terms. Now, it has risks. And I think the biggest risk is, do you somehow make the world then safe for large-scale conventional war? And we have to remember that in World War II, nuclear weapons kill 200,000 people, and bombs, tanks, bazookas, knives killed 50 million. But I set that against the risk of a continued reliance on nuclear deterrence, where the nuclear deterrence certainly worked in terms of maintaining a cool peace between the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. It worked. But there were five or six points where you could go back and point to and say, we came really close. And had deterrence failed, the possibility would have been 200 or 300 million dead. So you have to think through the risks. Now, I think it's a very different calculation for the Russians, because the Russians, it's a different geographical situation. They have NATO on one side. I believe that the Russians overly hype the threat that NATO poses, but they seem to have talked to themselves into there's a NATO threat there. They look at China. I think that makes them nervous. And so a non-nuclear world from the point of view of Russia, when you're dealing with advanced conventional forces in NATO and the United States and the large-scale conventional power that China could mount, I think is a very different proposition than seen from Washington. So getting them to go into the low hundreds is probably real difficult. What I would hope to do, though, is you could persuade them and say, look, you don't need 4,500 today. You can have just as much security with 2,200, and also then begin to get the U.S. to address some of the other concerns that you've raised.
Great. Well, thank you. It was masterful, Steve, and really opened up a lot of subjects. So let's bring all of you in with your questions. You want to take one at a time or two? What's the...
Okay.
Well, so we'll begin with this second row here, and we'll take both of the questions and then go back to Steve for comment. So I guess, do we have microphones anywhere? Here we come. So, yeah, as the microphone is approaching, please identify yourselves, even if I know who you are, and pose the question as you wish. Here in the second row.
Yeah.
And start with Harlan in the... Okay, either way.
I'm Harlan Ullman. Thanks for a very, very good presentation, Steve. I want to ask a broader question in this context about Russia. As you know, Ash Carter has said we have a 4+1 matrix in which the United States has to deter and, if necessary, defeat in a war Russia or China or. What do you think it takes to deter or defeat Russia? And is that really something sensible to be staying in the open public? I think that contingency planning, yes. But when you're talking about deterring and defeating Russia as the number one defense priority, as the services are, that to me seems reckless. But in any event, what does it take to deter and defeat in your minds? And I'd like Mike to respond to that as well.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm Albert Wolf. I'm the LA for Foreign Affairs in the office of Congressman Steve Chabot. I'm just asking this on, my own personal capacity. A lot of discussions of cross-domain deterrence discuss the so-called new triad of space, cyber, and then nuclear. And what I wanted to get at is sort of a broader question. How should new technologies be taken into account when formulating, some of the nuclear arms control agreements that you spoke about now, you talk about in your report, for example, high-energy weapons, robotics, et cetera? Thank you.
Okay. Two good questions. Well, let me take the second one first. Now, this is actually, I think, one of the things that is more complicated than it was during the Cold War. During the Cold War, when you talked about strategic stability, it was between the United States and the Soviet Union, and you looked at the mix of offensive nuclear weapons and missile defense. And of course, for most of that period, or actually for all of the Cold War, at least from 1972 on, missile defense was limited by the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. I think strategic stability now has to be broadened. You have to bring China into the equation. If you bring China into the equation, then you have to talk about India, Pakistan. You have these new domains, space, obviously important, cyber. And I'm not going to try to venture answers on those, in part because since my daughter went away to college, my cyber capabilities dropped significantly. But we have to figure out, how do you address that? Are there some areas where cross-domain deterrence works? And part of the question is just, does the U.S. government, I don't think we have an articulated cyber deterrence policy. Several weeks ago, the vice president told Meet the Press, we got hit, we're going to go back and hit the people who did it, and you probably won't notice that. That's I think, the most public statement I've seen, whereas with nuclear weapons, there's a more articulated policy of deterrence. Before we can start talking about cross-domain deterrence, I think we have to then, what is our policy in cyber? What would be the red lines, those sorts of things that might draw an American cyber attack in response? And at that point, I think your strategic stability calculations get significantly different. I still think, though, with the kinds of reductions and the steps I'm taking and talking about in this paper, is you could do that safely, even in a world where you have new domains and new players to take account of. What does it take to deter the Russians? I guess I'd make three points. I think the Russians see, understand, and respect American strategic nuclear forces. And they understand there's going to be a modernization program. They're doing a lot now, as I said, replacing a lot of old stuff. 10 years from now, we're going to be doing a lot, again, replacing a lot of old stuff. So they understand that. I think part of the focus I would do is perhaps in doing a little bit in more enhancement of American conventional capabilities, particularly with regards to Europe. And this is the one where I think NATO has probably made the smart decision in terms of what it's doing in the Baltic states, deploying a battalion to each of the three Baltic states in Poland, in the sense of putting the capability there that will reinforce the red line between Russia and NATO territory, but also is not going to be usually provocative. I mean, a 1,000-person battalion in Lithuania is not going to set off and drive towards Moscow. But it is going to serve the purposes of a very robust tripwire if in the very unlikely case, perhaps not zero, that there were ever a conflict involving the Russians in the Baltic states. The one thing that I guess I would be critical of this administration of, though, on the deterrence question is I think they have not responded in the way that they could have to what I regard as unfortunate and unsettling saber-rattling that comes out of Moscow with references to, back in... I guess it was about a year and a half ago, in a documentary on the seizure of Crimea, President Putin says, and I was prepared to put Russian nuclear forces on alert. And those of us who are following the Russian-Ukraine situation going, why would you do that? I mean, Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons back in the 1990s, in part because they had an assurance from Russia that Russia would respect Ukraine's territorial integrity. Things that are said enough where the Russian ambassador in Denmark feels that he can go out and threaten to target nuclear weapons on Denmark. And I think that in conjunction with this idea, and it's a bit of a nebulous idea that the Russians use about de-escalation, that they might escalate to use of a small number of nuclear weapons to resolve a conflict on terms acceptable to them. And it's a interesting question because I've been in probably three track two conversations in the last year and a half where the Russians have said that is absolutely not a part of formal doctrine. But I think people at NATO and in the U.S. government are actually preparing that it might well be. And this idea that you could somehow use a few nuclear weapons and that it would be small and that would be somehow different, I wish the administration in its communications with Moscow, but also publicly, would not let that stand. I mean, I would like to see a senior official go out and say, look, in Moscow, you should not think that the use of a nuclear weapon, because it's small or the use is discreet, is somehow going to be different, as opposed to saying, no, if you use that nuclear weapon, you will have crossed a threshold, you will have breached a threshold that hasn't been breached in 70 years, And you should anticipate that the consequences are going to be unpredictable, potentially very nasty and catastrophic, and try to basically devalue that, because I don't think it's a good thing for the American deterrent posture, the NATO deterrent posture, for some in Moscow to try to think, well, yeah, we could probably use a couple of these things and somehow get away with it.
That's a great answer. I don't have a whole lot to add. I think one just different take I might put forth, which I think is complementary, or at least I don't intend it to disagree, is that I think on the nuclear-to-nuclear Russia-U.S. showdown or confrontation, it's not so much a concern about who might have 5% greater firepower or survivability in a hypothetical all-out. It's more the issue of test of wills as to who would be willing to back up whatever commitments we're talking about with whatever force. And as I think you know, Harlan, we had General Sir Richard Sheriff here a couple weeks ago talking about his new novel, War with Russia. And I think his overriding concern was that our commitment to the Baltic states might not be clear enough, and Russia might therefore be tempted to nip away, chip away at it. He was a little more concerned, I believe, when he began writing the book than he might be today, because the European Reassurance Initiative has begun to move these four battalions into place, which I consider about the right magnitude of response. And even General Sheriff didn't want a whole lot more than that himself, even though he was dramatizing the stakes with this novel, War with Russia. And so I think that the key point here is, even though I wasn't necessarily even in favor of NATO expansion to the Baltic states, now that they're in, we have to be very clear that they're in and that we intend to defend them as need be. How we would handle any future members is another subject, and I'm less inclined to go down that road. But I do think we have to be unambiguous in our commitment to Baltic state security, which is not just a question about threatening a nuclear response, not that you said it was, not just a question of who could win a hypothetical nuclear showdown precipitated by a Baltic struggle. It would be as much as anything, how well could we apply tougher economic sanctions? If Russia, let's say, seized one town in eastern Latvia to try to invalidate Article 5, knowing that we would probably be half crazy to, you know, send 500,000 troops and five tank divisions to liberate that one town at the risk of nuclear war. On the other hand, if we do nothing, we've essentially acquiesced in Russian aggression against a NATO member state. So we need to think very hard about a number of options, which would include, I think, frankly, escalation and economic warfare to a point where this could never be, from a Russian point of view, a desirable idea to pursue. So that's where I worry as much about deterrence as I do about who can take out the other's hard aim points with, you know, higher probability than the other.
Can I follow up? Because I think Steve made a point about
made a really important point about the propaganda issues. As you know, the Russians have set an Iskander missile into Konigsberg and caliber of cruise missiles that are nuclear capable into the Baltics. And as you may know, last week they'd had a nuclear defense, civil defense exercise in Moscow, which is a signal in which they want to emphasize the fact that they have numerical advantages in tactical weapons, nuclear weapons, to intimidate Europe. And they're doing a pretty good job of that. And so, therefore, it seems to me that your point about countering this is very, very important. And so how would you go on with a more dramatic or at least a better PR strategy to deal with the declaratory warnings that are coming out of Russia, where they are really, quite frankly, way ahead of us?
Yeah. Well, as I said, I think I would tackle directly this idea, this de-escalation doctrine. Because, I don't want the Russians to persuade themselves that, yeah, in a crisis we could use one or two weapons and somehow get away with it. I think personally, once that threshold is crossed, you know, all bets are off. And I want Moscow to, you know, understand that. But again, I think, you know, the conventional force postures is what I would focus on in Europe. And I we're moving in the right direction. You know, depending on how things, there might be some other things that you could do. If you Google Earth the Sierra Army Depot in Northern California, you'll see lined up rows and rows of M1 tanks. You know, putting another couple of those tanks pre-positioned in a place like Germany, that would increase their deterrent value as opposed to having them in California. So I think there are things that you could and should be doing at the conventional level. But again, anticipating that, what I want the Russians to understand is they can't escalate to a nuclear level without horrific consequences, and that even at a conventional level, you know, there will be NATO resources there that in the end are going to defeat them.
Okay, let's go to the back of the room this time, and then we'll keep mixing it up. So there's a gentleman in a red sweater. And then we'll take that, and then we'll come up here to a woman in her orange jacket, and then go to Steve.
Hi, Alex Sanchez, I write for GN's Defense Weekly and CIMSEC. My question is about, when it comes to U.S. Nuclear forces, my question is about military training and military morale. 3 years ago, we had the Maelstrom base cheating scandal. Five months ago, more or less, there was a drug usage scandal in, I think, Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. I'm wondering, as you talk about renewing the equipment, what changes are being made in the training, in the morale of what ways is morale being increased among the U.S. military personnel that is in charge of protecting these very important and critical weapons? Thank you.
And then up here, please.
Good afternoon. I'm Eun Jung Lim. I'm teaching Korean politics at Sai Chan Hopkins University. I really enjoyed the discussions between you and my former professor at Columbia University. My question is, of course, I do understand the rationales behind the downsizing or arm control between the Russia and here the United States. But how about this? I mean, nowadays in South Korea, one of the key allies of the United States, the fear or, again, the anxiety about this kind of shrinking or withdrawal of the United States is really becoming a big concern. So now more and more Korean people think that we might need to have our own nuclear weapons too. So how would you think about this kind of situation, and how would you recommend for the next administration to assure these East Asian allies?
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let me start on the training question. I think actually, you know, the U.S. Air Force recognized that there was an issue there, you know, several years ago, and they're trying to find ways to rectify those problems. And so hopefully those programs are going to be successful, and you're not going to see a reoccurrence of those issues. And it does seem to be, I think, within the U.S. military over the last several years, there has been a renewed focus on operation of nuclear forces, you know, training people and such. On the South Korea issue, I mean, this I think it gets to the really difficult question, which is, you know, deterrence of an attack against the United States itself is pretty easy, I think. How do you extend that deterrent to cover countries like South Korea, Japan, NATO countries? Where, and the question goes back to the Cold War, you know, with regards to NATO, we're always asked, is an American president really prepared to risk Chicago to defend Bonn? And so part of it is not only deterring the other guys, in this case North Korea, but also is assuring, you know, your government, the South Korean government, that commitment's there. A lot of it, I think, is just consultations, just having a conversation. This is how we think about these things. This is how we would respond. And this was done in NATO, I mean, back in the 1960s. I describe it as a software solution as opposed to new weapons, but just actually having conversations so that you raise the allies' comfort level in terms of, we now understand how the United States thinks about these issues, we understand how the United States would respond. And that takes a lot of time and effort, but I think it can be successful. I mean, in the case of North Korea, it does seem to me, it's very hard for me to see a situation in which North Korea used a nuclear weapon. If that happened, my guess is it would be almost certain there would be an American nuclear response. Now, that's going to be a presidential decision, but it seems to me that if there was not an American nuclear response, the risk is the other side says, hey, I got away with it once. Can I get away with it 2, 3, 4, or 5 times? So I think there is that protection on the nuclear side. If there were a major conflict between North Korea and South Korea, and it did not go nuclear, it stayed at the conventional level, you've got, I think, 24,000 American troops there who are going to be in that conflict from day one. I mean, that's a pretty good indicator of U.S. commitment. And again, I would argue in that situation, I'm not sure anybody would want to make first use of an American nuclear weapon. Because if the United States did that, then what might be the North Korean response to South Korea? So I think there are some ways to talk about where you may somewhat reduce your reliance on nuclear weapons, you know, but still maintain a strong commitment and assure allies that commitment's there for their defense.
If you don't mind, I'm going to add to that, because that was a really very good answer, and I'd just like to make a couple of additional points. A couple of weeks ago, I wrote a column in the Wall Street Journal in which I argued that Donald Trump's thinking about Korea was one of his more objectionable ideas, because in fact, South Korea is spending, as you undoubtedly well know, 2.5% of its GDP on its own defense, which is one of the highest numbers among any American ally in the world, especially if you don't count some of the Middle Eastern countries that are at war or virtually in a war zone. And on top of that fact, as Steve says, we have this very longstanding commitment. We have, you know, the resolute, clear commitment through the presence of more than 20,000 Americans on the peninsula, close to 30,000, I think. And on top of that, you know, this is a place where we found out the hard way what happens when you start to get shaky in your commitments. That's what happened back in 1950, and we shouldn't make the same mistake twice. But I also think, to back Steve's arguments up, that if, for example, the North Koreans decided in a future conflict that we need our high technology assets more than they need theirs, and that ours are more vulnerable to a nuclear strike, or that Western populations are weaker and can be more easily intimidated, and therefore they could try a nuclear weapon or two in a sort of limited way, high altitude burst over an airfield, for example, trying not to cause a lot of civilian fatalities at first, but to send the message they're willing to cross that threshold, then I agree with Steve. We would have to do the same kind of thing ourselves. And in that situation, we would have to leave no doubt. We don't have to necessarily escalate it first, especially if they still have 15 weapons left and we don't know where they are. But we would have to indicate that we're not going to be, assuming Seoul agrees with Washington on this, that we're not going to be somehow browbeaten into submission or revealed to be irresolute. One last thing, which is, I think, very fortunate, is that after a decade of trying to pursue this ill-conceived idea to transfer military command to the South Koreans, or essentially to distribute it into the two different militaries where you would dissolve the combined integrated command structure, the United States and South Korea are no longer in a hurry to do that. They've declared a conditions-based approach towards changing their command, which to me is a perfect way of saying we're never going to change it as long as there's a North Korean threat. And that's what the policy should be. We've spent 30 years in the United States under Goldwater, Nichols, and other military reforms trying to integrate and simplify and streamline our military commands. We shouldn't be trying to do just the opposite with our USROK alliance. And luckily, we're not any longer. So that's one more reason why I feel fairly good. Once we get through this U.S. election, which has raised some of the biggest, oldest, and, you know, most existential questions about the future of the alliance, we'll be able to remind people of some of the reassuring facts. Okay, it's maybe the sixth or seventh row.
Thank you. Dean Rust. The elephant in the room, it seems to me, is partly the fact that there's no longer bipartisan consensus in the United States in support of arms control. We can say all we want about what the next administration might try to do, but if it's Hillary Clinton, you know what's going to happen on the other side. If it's Donald Trump, you have seen Republican willingness to reduce reliance on nuclear weapons over the past 10, 15 years, but not in a treaty context. They say the world is unpredictable, and they have to be able to respond, not bound by treaties. And, of course, combination of those two things makes it extremely difficult, whether you're a Democrat trying to do some of this stuff or whether you're a Republican, to get to some of the things you want to you think that the next administration ought to do. So have we reached a point where arms control is over until the Republican national security establishment comes back to embrace some of this stuff, or is there a chance sometime in the next 10, 15 years that that'll happen? So,
that's a domestic political question, and I answer at some hazard. No, I think you're right. Certainly, I think the room for arms control agreements, particularly that are concluded by a Democratic administration, you know, and the possibility that it could get consent to ratification by a Senate and winning sufficient support from the Republicans, it's a lot more difficult than it was, you know, even a couple decades ago. And the example I'll hold out is, if you look at the New START Treaty and compare it with the 2002 Strategic Offensive Reductions Treaty that was signed by the George W. Bush administration with the Russians, the limits in those treaties are actually pretty close. I mean, slightly different counting rules, but the numbers, they come out about the same. The treaty that was signed by President Bush was 2 pages. It had no agreed counting rules, no agreed definitions, no verification measures. And in fact, I think the Russians were counting, we were counting more things than the Russians were counting. The New START treaty was 500 pages. It had detailed verification measures, precise counting rules, things like that. And if you go back and you look at how senators voted, I think there were either 16 or 18 Republican senators who voted for the treaty in 2002 and then voted against New START. And so I think there's a certain degree of politics, unfortunately, which has intruded on this. So there are a couple questions here. You know, can you come up with an arrangement and can you persuade the Senate that, in fact, these arms control arrangements do serve American interests? The other factor that might come at play here is, you know, how do Democrats in Congress react towards a fairly expensive strategic modernization program, where you're now seeing questions among some about what the bill is going to be for this? I think the Republicans in the Senate were very effective in 2010 in mobilizing to say, in order to get support for the New START Treaty and its ratification, the administration has to make certain commitments on strategic force modernization. Like, I wonder, will Democrats in the Senate say, okay, well, we're prepared to support that modernization in return, though, for reasonable arms control? And so in my ideal world, which is probably naive and probably won't happen given the difficult politics, is you could have a situation where arms control brings numbers down, but you also then have support on both sides for ensuring that the forces that are within those lower limits are actually modernized. I'm not going to make a prediction that will happen. I would like to see it happen. We'll have to see. And a lot of, I think, will depend on, you know, what's the composition of the Senate. I mean, if there is a Democratic president in the White House in 2017, in full disclosure, I very much hope there will be. In terms of winning support for a treaty, how many Republican votes would that president need?
Any other questions? Yes, sir.
Steve, it's I had a chance to read your report, and I find it, I really compliment you on a very balanced, on this hand, on the other hand. It really, I mean that. But there are a couple of things I think you should examine. One is going to 10 submarines is really going to 8 because you have a backfit problem in the 2030 to 2040 period. You can't get to where you want to go with the numbers you talk about. Second of all, the notion that the Air Force supports a service life extension program for Minuteman versus modernization is erroneous. I know what RAND did, but RAND doesn't speak for the Air Force. In fact, the Air Force has testified before Congress that a SLEP would cost more than a modernization. And if you're talking about the next 10 years, that's absolutely true. If you're talking about 30 years, no. But the next two FYDEPs of an incoming administration are going to be to 2024, 25. And there, the costs of a SLEP exceed that of modernization. And if you do a SLEP of 250 missiles, you got to do a SLEP of 150 test missiles. And the issue there is not so much test assets as accuracy. That's one of the big issues, and the cost of maintenance. And that also includes the C-cubed command and control. The third issue, which Michael raised, which you go through in your report, is this idea that for Minuteman to survive, it has to be used first, and therefore to de-alert it or take the warheads off is necessary. Bob Bell, in 1997, had a press conference at the White House in which he said, U.S. policy has not been launch under attack or launch on warning. It is not. In fact, he had to have a special press conference to persuade the media that had gotten a hold of a presidential directive and nuclear posture review and assumed that that was our policy. And he pointed out, this is November 1997, it's online, we haven't had that policy. In fact, we spend all this money precisely because we don't have to launch Minuteman under attack or on warning. We can ride out an attack. And if there's not an attack on CONUS, there's a regional attack in Europe or Asia, Minuteman will be available. So I would urge you to, I understand you look at both sides of those issues, but in your recommendations, you talk about de-alerting or even taking warheads off of missiles, which, as the Russians said here, as Brad Roberts said here just a few months ago, you get into a re-alerting race. And as the Russians said, how do you verify it? Because you can't on a de-alerting thing. So I would urge you to take a look at both the backfit problem, as Admiral Benedict has laid out, and the Minuteman SLEP versus modernization. And finally, I asked General Weinstein, why do you want to modernize? Do you want just a new shiny? Or does it really mean these things are going to deteriorate and not be usable? And I asked him Friday at Heritage. And he said, we absolutely have to replace these systems because they're being degraded and they are not going to survive beyond the time in which they need to be replaced. This is not a matter of, oh, nice to have. The problems of the hull life for subs, the problem in terms of stealth is an issue, and the issue on Minuteman is both accuracy and cost of maintenance. But otherwise, I want to compliment you on a really well-done report, because I could see a lot of things that a lot of us in the pro-modernization side have been saying, but you also, I think, fairly laid out what those who want to do something else. So again, I compliment you.
Well, thank you, Peter. Let me I think, though, just to be clear, I think I did say on ICBMs, though the Air Force has made clear its preferences for a new ICBM.
Right.
There is the RAND report out there, which is just the alternative. Again, it may be something worth thinking about if there's a cost issue. On the question of launch under attack, my paper, I didn't advocate taking the warheads off the ICBMs, but I did say, you know, maybe the White House can just tell the Air Force, you do not have to plan for launch under attack. I think it generally makes sense to do what we can to give the president hours and even days to consider use of nuclear weapons. And this is going to be the most monumental decision that he or she ever makes. And so I want that president to have as much time as they need to make it. And the launch under attack, and I agree, I think it's a little bit unclear exactly what the status is. I mean, I go back to the 2013 statement that the Defense Department sent to Congress on the implementation study for the nuclear posture review. And it talked about examining options for moving away from launch under attack, but still didn't quite completely give it up. So when I'm talking about de-alerting, it's not in the sense of you don't have to do anything physical. You can just say to the Air Force, you don't have to train, practice, because you should not anticipate that you're going to get an order to launch on 4 or 5 minutes' notice, which I think also is just highly impractical. I mean, when you look at the timelines and that amount of decision time that the president would actually have to make a launch decision if you see a couple hundred ICBMs headed towards the United States, you know, my guess is the first question the president will ask is, are we really, really sure? On the submarine question, I take your point about the numbers of submarines, although I think actually you might get to a point where in the 2040s, you're talking about 10 submarines maybe being 9 if you plan for one being out, because you're going to have less time in the shipyard. We're already in a situation where the Navy has said basically for most of the 2030s it'll be able to get by. It's going to get by with 10 submarines. Yeah, but I think when you get with a new submarine, though, because of the lesser time, because you don't need to refuel the reactor, you don't have to have that much, and you don't have to have two submarines out at the time. But at a cost of, I mean, when you look at the construction costs, though, and the life cycle average costs, and if you went from 12 to 10, you could probably save about $50 billion over the course of the program. So there, again, I'm trying to look at the programs also not just in terms of requirements, but in terms of what we can afford. And I worry right now that the program that the military has is going to be very difficult to fund come 2025.
Let's see if we have a final question, and if not, we'll get you all out to start getting ready for trick-or-treating on a little bit on the early side. But any final question? Well, if not, please join me in thanking Steve, and best wishes to you all.